Coming up next on this episode of The Social Hour, Digital Royalties' Amy Jo Martin joins us to talk social, strategy, and celebrities, Yelp's big makeover, and a new publishing medium. All that and the rich kids of Instagram up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for the Social Hour is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is The Social Hour with Sarah Lane and Amber MacArthur, episode 73, recorded Friday, August 17th, 2012. This episode of The Social Hour is brought to you by the new Squarespace, which introduces a new content management system, making it faster and easier to create a high-quality website or blog. Plus, more than 50 new features, including mobile responsive designs with automatic device scaling. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code SOCIALHOUR8. And by Ford. Ford invites us tech geeks to join the conversation, submit ideas, and grab a tech geek badge at social.ford.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Social Hour from Twit World headquarters in Petaluma, California. I'm Sarah Lane.
And I'm Amber MacArthur in the Canadian Twit headquarters in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Hello, Sarah. How are you doing?
Amber, I'm good. I'm good. It's been a long week. I was in Las Vegas last weekend doing a little pool partying. I think you saw some of my path photos.
I sure did. It looked a little chaotic.
We decided to go big or go home. We did both, actually. We went big and then we went home. But it was a lot of fun. So, yes, I've sort of limped through the week. And here we are on Friday with all sorts of social stuff to talk about, as usual.
Oh, yeah, tons to talk about. And, of course, I'm most excited. We mentioned this last week on the show that we have a guest this week. Amy Jo Martin is going to join us. And she is the CEO and founder of Digital Royalty, a company that does a lot of amazing social media work. And she also has a book coming out. So excited to have her on. And I guess now is a great time to introduce her. Hi, Amy Jo.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on here. I'm actually in Las Vegas, so I'm definitely looking forward to some pool partying myself this weekend.
Isn't that funny? I asked you right before the show, where are you located? And you said Las Vegas. And, you know, I guess in this day and age, you can be based out of pretty much wherever you want. But why are you based out of Las Vegas for anybody who's unfamiliar with the Digital Royalty?
Good question. We actually just moved our headquarters here to downtown Las Vegas as a result of an investment and partnership with Tony Hsieh, the CEO of Zappos, and Baron Davis, an NBA player. Tony Hsieh is working on a revitalization project down here in downtown Las Vegas and doing some pretty cool stuff and investing in a lot of different tech companies. So it's definitely a place to watch. We are growing, as is a lot of other companies that are moving into town.
Could you talk a little bit about your early experience in digital marketing? I've read some of your recent work, and you've done some amazing things. How did you get involved in this business?
Sure. So my background's in sports and marketing, and I used to work for the Phoenix Suns NBA team. I was in charge of digital media and research and started realizing that a lot of our corporate sponsors, our corporate partners, wanted to get closer to the athletes and closer to the fans. And the traditional sponsorship assets like TV avails and in-game signage and stuff like that wasn't quite as attractive. So I started just experimenting with social media. And Shaquille O'Neal played for the team at the time and helped him develop his strategy. So we just started experimenting, doing some kind of off-the-wall things. We created something I called the Random Acts of Shackness, and really just worked on bridging the virtual world with the physical world to prove that it really was him behind this voice, and then started to grow. The company started to grow. I left the Phoenix Suns and started building a team and working with other brands outside of sports as well.
So that's what you're doing at the Digital Royalty now.
Actually, a big focus and a result of this move and partnership is to focus on our education division. So a year ago, the company is nearly 4 years old, but a year ago we launched Digital Royalty University. So this is a education program and developed curriculum and modules to help educate our clients, our corporate brands that we work with. So like DoubleTree by Hilton. And for the last year, we've been creating more different modules and curriculum that allow us to teach each individual and each discipline within a company how social communication impacts their role. So from legal to HR to PR, not just your marketing, communications, digital, obvious disciplines, but with the everything and everyone, and how culture, company culture, and communication really integrate well, and the intersection is often social. So on October 2nd, we're taking all of the curriculum and the modules we've created and opening them up to the world through an e-learning platform. So Digital Royalty University and the classes will be available to anyone and everyone. And it's a buy one, give one model. So for every learner that purchases a class, Digital Royalty is giving back a class to teachers. So they can...
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Now, something that I've seen you talk about both on your site, within your company's website, but also even as recent as in a Twitter message that you sent out just a little while ago, is this concept of renegades. And I think that from what I read, your book includes some information around this idea of the digital renegade. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, sure. So the story and really genesis of the renegade was when I worked for the Phoenix Suns, I was on a flight with the team and my boss, and we were headed to play the Lakers. And I had been constantly dabbling and getting my hands slapped because I had been dabbling in social media, trying to recruit everyone from the president of the team to the mascot. And my boss called me a renegade. And here we are on October 2nd. My book comes out. Renegades write the rules, really just because at the time there were no rules. And that was part of the healthy tension, was that, you know, everybody likes to have rules. And I created what I call innovation allergies. And every company and every individual, you know, kind of goes through their exposure of these allergies, the types of things when people say, you know, that's not the way we've always done it, or we've tried that and it didn't work, or what if it doesn't work? Just really kind of throwing those out the window and looking at different ways to approach things is important, and it just so happens that social media is a great tool for innovation. So that's where renegades came from.
When you say that you were getting your hand slapped, was that the problem that you were running into with the Phoenix Sun franchise, is that they were just maybe not tuned in enough to what social media was all about, so they were uncomfortable with you moving forward?
To a certain extent, and this was 4 or 5 years ago, so the concept of Facebook and Twitter really being embraced for corporate use and corporate benefit wasn't quite developed yet. So since then, I mean, the Phoenix Suns and the NBA have done amazing things and have been very progressive with social media. It was just really before its time, and I think that I just did a lot of coloring outside the lines and asked forgiveness instead of permission, but I would always bring my results with me. So sitting in revenue meetings, the question would be, you know, you want to plan a what up, a tweet up? And I would say, well, yeah, and this is how we can increase loyalty, fan loyalty and affinity, and also bring in a sponsor and generate revenue through ticket sales. And so it just was a time of healthy tension, and every company, all of our clients, even large global clients, go through that same adversity. But that means something usually is going right if that adversity kind of shadow is there. You're doing something that hasn't been done before.
I know a lot of people right now who are in the social media marketing business or digital marketing business, whatever you want to call it, they're feeling a little bit of social media fatigue. You know, everybody's a little tired. There's a lot of experts out there. There's a lot of talk out there. What tools or services are you excited about, you know, in August 2012? What things are you seeing that you think this truly is the future of digital, and these are some services that we're going to pay attention to?
That's a great question. I was actually just interviewed earlier and talked a lot about the concept of fatigue and social fatigue. There's only so much time we have in our day, and there's constantly new platforms, and at what point is there a point of diminishing returns? And the education piece, in my opinion, you know, social media, whatever platform we're talking about, and I do see a lot of consolidation happening, or envision it happening. Whatever platform we're talking about, it truly is the ultimate equalizer. So if we look at it more of the communication tool versus media, and because it's more like the telephone than the television technically, and look at different ways to use it and what are the benefits, how students can get jobs and build their personal brands. It's becoming more and more important. Our buy one, give one component is really because where our passion, skill, and purpose collide as team members here at Digital Royalty, it's to educate and give people a voice. And the importance of personal branding, even at a very young age, is more powerful now and more important than ever. And so giving back to the teachers so they can help students understand the power of social as well as help the parents understand, we think is a good way to scale the act of good, to scale the value that someone has. Doesn't mean, just because we work with a lot of celebrities, doesn't mean that you have to be a celebrity to build influence and be successful with social media. So I think just reversing the concept of just using social to market or socialize and starting to kind of think of the other benefits that it has to our society is a different approach that we need to take, and even the government for that matter.
When you say celebrities and you mentioned Shaquille O'Neal, I remember Shaquille O'Neal being one of the first celebrities that at least came across my radar on Twitter. And everybody followed him because he was obviously a big basketball star, but funny and goofy, and he would tweet out pictures of himself, and people just loved that. And that happened before so many other celebrities kind of got on board, so he seemed like a pioneer. What was it like? Did he approach you? Did you approach him? I mean, how did you guys sit down and say, okay, this is going to be our social media strategy, or was there even one?
It wasn't necessarily that formal, but he definitely has an affinity toward just new things, technology, pioneering. And his number one goal in life is to make people laugh, literally. He says it all the time. And so this was the perfect tool to kind of expose the Shaquille behind the Shaq. Everybody has seen him on the court and the interviews, but this was exposing different aspects of his life. And literally what happened one day was I was at my desk in the front office at the Suns, and I got a call from basketball operations, and they said, can you come down to the locker room? Shaquille needs some help. He wants to tweet. And so it started there, and his willingness to be aggressive, and there's very little that makes Shaquille uncomfortable, so he was willing to try these crazy things. The first random act of Shaqness was I asked him to just stand on a street corner and tweet his whereabouts because people didn't believe that it was his voice. There was some skepticism about whether or not it was really Shaquille in the very, very beginning. And people kind of thought, was this Amy Jo Shaqeteering behind the scenes, or who is this? And so he did it, and you got to hand it to him. I mean, we didn't know exactly what would happen, but sure enough, fans show up instantly, the media shows up, and we continued to kind of perfect this stunt, this kind of hide and tweet stunt. And the first fan to show up got tickets to the game the next night. And bridging the virtual world and the physical world became so obvious that that was super powerful, because we would record video of this happening and then repurpose it and circulate it out to his fan base that was growing. So he, you know, it was very organic, and it was a lot of just, I didn't even meet his agents until later on down the road, or his manager. It was just, hey, I think you should do this. Or did you see this person's reaching out to you, or this fan just made this super cool photo for you, or something. Let's engage more. And his intent was in the right place. And so that's why he's able to build such a base of friends.
Very cool story. Now, aside from bridging the virtual world as well as the offline world, just one more question from me for people out there who are trying to figure out what they're doing. What piece of advice that you have in your new book coming out that you can share with us today about how someone can build their own, what they should keep in mind when they're doing it?
Absolutely. I guess a couple of quick things. It's all about delivering value. So really identifying what is your value and how can you deliver it when, where, and how your audience wants to receive it. And looking at the different types of value that we offer as individuals, and not just focusing on one specific thing. So just because we all might have one area of focus with our careers or one hobby, the only differentiating factor is us as human beings, because humans connect with humans, not logos. And I'm constantly preaching, you know, let's humanize the brand. So the more we can build the value and have the value be us and our personality and our value offering, not connected to specifically what we're doing, the more diverse of a audience we can reach and more sustainable, because typically your personality stays pretty much the same. So that's something that I would advise, is identify that value, but have different value buckets. It's not just about one thing. So that's a good place to start. And then experimenting. Fail often and early and continue to experiment. And eventually that turns into a best practice process if you're listening and making adjustments.
Amber and I are always talking about, we get a lot of people saying, well, I work at this company, maybe there's 10 of us, we want to have a social presence. How do we sort of build that from scratch? And it's obviously different for a lot of companies, but we sort of feel like, even though we're representing our show, The Social Hour, we like to keep our identities online as us, because we're not actually playing roles of any kind. I mean, this is just us doing our thing. And we'll still be us, you know, in the next phase when, you know, we might be doing something else. And that seems the safest, because our unique identities is something that isn't going to change, even though the other factors will. Is that something that you would suggest to other people working at companies who are building social strategies follow?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's right in line, I think, with my response just now. Your approach is definitely the philosophy that we believe in. And furthermore, I think the personality strategy, if you will, of really exposing your personality, even if it's under the umbrella of a company of 10 or 10,000, it allows your audience, whether it's fans, customers, guests, to relate and connect with you at a deeper, more emotional connection level. So, you know, be real and use your best judgment was some advice that Tony Hsieh gave me years ago. And that's a pretty good rule to live by when you're thinking about your social strategy.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And for people who want to get your book, I know it's available this fall. I'll make sure to get a copy. And good luck with your new venture, because it sounds like, I know you've had the company for a while, but the new move to Las Vegas sounds very exciting. And hopefully you'll come back on the show one day too.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys having me on, and have a great weekend. Take care.
Thanks, Amy Jo. That's Amy Jo Martin, the founder and CEO of Digital Royalty, also the author of the book. Hold up that book one more time, Amy Jo. Renegades Write the Rules. I love that. Is that you? Is that you with a jetpack?
Yes, it's a real jetpack, too.
All right.
And quite the photo shoot we had there. It was on location. And you, too, can see the jetpack. Come visit in Las Vegas in the office. We have the jetpack.
That sounds awesome. I will not miss it the next time I'm out there. Have a great weekend, Amy Jo, and thanks again for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Quick reminder for everybody who may not be watching us live, we record The Social Hour live on Fridays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. But if you're not watching us live, you can always keep up with us or catch up to episodes you might have missed. Just go to twit.tv/TSH. That is our website. That is where all the shows live and breathe in perpetuity forever and ever. Any particular episode that you say, well, you know, I loved Amy Jo Martin. She had so many interesting things to say that I don't remember the name of her book, and where do I find out more about it? All of the links to everything that we talk about, and people's personal websites, if we have interviews and so on, are all on each of our episode pages. You just scroll down past the nice video, which you can watch in line on our page, and all of our external links are there. So don't worry if you ever miss anything. We try to make it really easy for you to keep up. All right, Amber, before we get into some of our news of the week, let's take a moment to thank Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of The Social Hour. Squarespace is really exciting right now because they have something called the new Squarespace, the Squarespace version 6, which uses all the latest web technologies, but also makes it easier than ever to put together an amazing website, which is hosted also, too. It's not just building something that looks cool. It's something that isn't going to go down if, for example, you're a podcaster and all of a sudden you kind of hit the big time and all of a sudden a bunch of people are hitting your page and they're trying to watch your video and that kind of stuff. I mean, you want a website that looks good but is really, really steady as well. New Squarespace has new templates. So even if you were familiar with Squarespace before, we always talked about how nice their templates are. And they're still nice, but there's some new stuff. So, you know, if you're ready to make a change, if you're already on TypePad or WordPress, or you have a different Squarespace layout and you're just kind of ready to take it to the next level, now is a really good time to do that. Also, and this is going to be interesting to all of our Social Hour viewers and listeners, better social media integration than ever, which is really important for people who have blogs but are online in a variety of other places and want their websites to reflect that, even if you don't have a blog. Maybe you're a photographer and you know, you don't take new pictures that you're updating for a month or something, but you're all over Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and the like. That can all be reflected in your template. In fact, you can automatically pull photos from Instagram into your site. You can sync pages and galleries to Facebook. You can auto-publish new blog entries on Twitter, so you let everybody know on Twitter that I've blogged again. That's what I do when I blog quite infrequently. And then you got those nice social media buttons for all the services. Google+, Foursquare, Dropbox, LinkedIn, Pinterest, StumbleUpon. The list goes on and on. Really, really, really good design. The new Squarespace integrates pretty much any website need you might ever have. Plus, they have domain registration, design, development, hosting, and customer support. So it's an all-in-one package. So if you want to try Squarespace out, if you haven't tried out yet, you can sign up for a free trial. You just go to squarespace.com and you click the try it free button. You don't need a credit card to try anything. So there's no like, oh, they're going to charge me if I forget type of thing at all. You just try out Squarespace, start building a website, see if it's right for you. If you decide to go ahead and purchase a plan, and they've got really, really a variety of plans that are very reasonable. Use the offer code SOCIALHOUR8 when you sign up and you get 10% off your first purchase on new Squarespace accounts. That includes monthly and annual plans. And don't forget about free domain registration with annual plans. So if you go for a year, you like Squarespace, you've put together something good, you're ready to go ahead and buy a year, you get 10% off of that plus free domain registration. Again, that code is SOCIALHOUR8. And we thank Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of The Social Hour. Amber, Facebook has been all over the news this week, which makes it no different than last week or the week before.
Or the year before.
Right, so. Or that. Latest, well, there's a couple. There's a couple stories I thought were interesting. The first one is not something that I will be taking advantage of anytime soon. But it's Facebook is now going to let me announce if and when someone, not me, becomes pregnant. So basically, when two people get engaged, they don't get to set their status to married yet. Well, I guess they could and lie about it, but they can say that they're engaged for whatever amount of time they're engaged for. Same thing when somebody becomes pregnant. Now you can tell everyone on your status that you are expecting. Amber, is this something that you want to know from people?
I guess it's not really a surprise since they're trying to promote and highlight people's birthdays more and celebrations. They're moving those up on the list of things that are highlighted on Facebook. So this seems like a natural fit, although I can only imagine some people out there having some fun with it and using it to set people off. Nonetheless, I think it kind of makes sense. And I think a lot of people appreciate that. You know, Sarah, we've talked about this before. Facebook tends to be a place where people post a ton of baby photos. And that's probably the number one occasion that I think of when I think of Facebook. Facebook as a place where people instantly go and they flock to see new baby pictures. So again, not a big surprise. You know, Facebook, like you said, continues to be in the headlines. Obviously, their stock price also dipped this past week, but they, you know, they keep plowing forward.
Yeah,
and this
they
is
do.
No exception.
The stock did dip. There were also a lot of early investors who had invested before Facebook's IPO that were allowed to unload stock as of yesterday. As of yesterday? Yeah, because yesterday the stock dipped under $20, which, I mean, it dipped to the lowest point that it had been since it was publicly traded, although it had also dipped to around $20 earlier this month. But, of course, everybody freaks out about that. You know, the model's flawed. Facebook's model is dependent on advertising revenue, and they are going to try out something new, which initially made me very skeptical, but I see why they have to do it. And that is, up until now, if Amber, you were to like a business on Facebook, because you and I are connected as friends on Facebook, I might see an ad from that business in line in my newsfeed. And in the mobile sense, there's even less of that. But even just on the web sense, what Facebook is now going to try out. So this is an experiment, they say, with a small number of businesses and a small number of Facebook users, is to let pages show news, show ads in the news feed to people who are not fans for a fee. So let's say that you do not like a particular business, even, you know, there's really no connection. And I might see that business because they've paid for me to see that placement in my newsfeed. So this, of course, you can say, well, this is very intrusive. It's going to ruin Facebook. It's just going to be a bunch of ads. The folks at Facebook have said, you know, and they're a little bit vague about it. They don't have specific numbers, but that they are still acutely aware that people don't just want to be looking at ads all day in their news feeds. They want ads to be able to be easily deciphered from other updates. So, and obviously it's in Facebook's best interest not to annoy people with ads so much that they stop going and clicking on other ads regularly. But this, I mean, I guess it's an inevitable move. But it, we're going to get ads that are not as targeted to us.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. You know, I'm just going through the TechCrunch article that they wrote about this, and I'm not so sure I agree with the premise here that they talk a little bit about how companies who went online previously and they amassed a huge amount of followers or a huge amount of likes or fans on Facebook, what was the point in them doing that? Because now you can just buy your way into people's news feeds. Well, Sarah, we know from working in the social space for quite a few years now, the reality is that a fan is way more valuable to a business than someone who randomly just sees your ad in a news feed on Facebook. So I think you can't treat those two people you can't put them in the same box. The reality is there's more value to that invested person who has come to your Facebook page and found you first. So I think if businesses still do this, I think that it's an opportunity perhaps to get noticed by people out there on Facebook who maybe didn't know that they could get a special deal or offer. But I think there still is value in having the pages and having people come and choose to be a member or a fan of that page.
I agree. I also wonder, though, how many brands or even people who have set up pages for themselves, you know, as a public figure or whatever, are really mad at the idea that they've spent the last few years trying to get as many people to like their page as possible so that their updates end up showing up in people's news feeds, in the public news feed. And now it's like, I went through all this trouble to try to get people the right way, and now all I had to do is give Facebook some money and you get the same placement. And you didn't even have to work to get these people to be your fans.
But I still don't think that they're getting the right people, right? I still think there's that risk that they put the ads out there and they get into news feeds. But whose news feeds are they? They're random people who maybe will like the brand or maybe won't. So I do think that investing and having the people like your page perhaps is still an important endeavor. So I see what you're saying. I just think at the end of the day, if Facebook makes it really clear that these are ads in your news feed, Sarah, what do we do when we see ads everywhere? We know more and more, especially younger people, just aren't clicking on these ads, right? Mm-hmm. They're not even looking at them, so that it takes away some of the value. So I appreciate Facebook's efforts to try to get more revenue from advertising. Nonetheless, I think there's less value in that mass advertisement within the newsfeed than there is from someone who has chosen to follow your updates.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's a page I follow, it's not a brand that I know of called The Daily Puppy. And it's just a picture of a dog every day. And I love that update in my news feed. I mean, it's like, I guess so whoever's behind that page could pay for placement in someone else's news feed. But yeah, it's not relevant to them at all. Oh, he's a little bloodhound puppy. Hey, guy. For any of our audio listeners, I just saw a picture of a dog and I melted a little bit. And that's my melting voice. it would make no sense at all for that to show up in, I don't know, I guess somebody's newsfeed who doesn't want to see puppies every day. So yes, there's a lot of truth in getting someone to like your page, not because you're tricking them into it or there's some sort of, you know, bizarre incentive, but because you've actually built up your brand enough so that people want to hear, what's new and interesting.
Yeah, you know, I sometimes think, and I know there's lots of people who have done well with Facebook advertisements, but I have to think sometimes that the traditional advertisement that a company puts out there to no targeted group is getting less valuable all the time. You know, we saw it with banners. Eventually people clicked on them and then they completely stopped. So I just don't think in the social media space that is the smartest and most advanced way to build up your loyal community. But I'll stop ranting about that now because clearly I could go on forever, Sarah. And I know we have lots more news to cover, including Yelp and their extreme home page makeover. I love this headline that you chose. And I know that you are a Yelp user. You use it fairly frequently. I went and checked out the makeover, the screenshot that I saw within this article. And I think it would be better for you to kind of talk about some of the differences, because at first glance, it looked not that different to me. But I guess if you dive in, it does.
Yeah, I thought the exact same thing.
Okay, you know, good.
It's really funny. So this is from the Yelp blog. We're zooming in on the screenshot that they were showing off to say, look, our homepage is totally redesigned. And at first glance, you go, what is different? This looks exactly like the old homepage. Well, there are a few differences. And it's really weird. Whoever from Yelp took that photo goes to a lot of the same places I do. So I was extremely confused at first because I'm looking at that screenshot and it's like, I go there and I go there, and because it was a personalized thing. That's kind of the meat of this, is that Yelp has become, and this is for people who are logged in, by the way. I mean, if you go to Yelp.com and you don't actually have a profile and account, this isn't going to apply to you as much, but I do. I'm looking at my own Yelp homepage right now, and what it has is pretty much more front and center recent activity from people who are not only near me but friends that I've friended on Yelp, or my own activity. Here's my profile on the right hand side. I've got friend requests from people, you know, I may or may not know, Facebook friends, pending compliments from folks, review of the day. Somebody wrote a review of House of Prime Rib, which is running steady at 5 stars in San Francisco. It's a very popular restaurant. And then if I go down the page a little bit more, we've got a new businesses area. So that's really fun for me. I like to know about new businesses. Best of San Francisco. And then Fresh Lists, which is a community organized group of lists that people in my community can make. And I am based out of San Francisco, so those kinds of lists are going to show up for me because that's where Yelp knows where I am. For example, somebody made a list about SF hipster joints. And yeah, with the description, if you were a nerd like me in school, these places will make you feel cool, at least temporarily, for an hour or so. Like 15 Romolo. Oh, see, that place is too crowded. I wouldn't go there. Or Bar Crudo. Or Bar Chartier. I don't know. I don't know if I call these all hipster joints. But that's kind of the idea that you can get out of Yelp, is that it's not only designed to be more personalized to you, but also help things surface that are relevant to the community of people that are either nearby you or are your friends, even if they don't live in the same city. Amber, I have said it before that I'm kind of on the fence. I think this is a good update. I mean, it really, I logged in, my homepage is updated, and all of a sudden I really did get a lot of good information right off the bat, within just a couple minutes of looking around. But I feel like Yelp is really good as a review site and not so good as like a check-in social thing. I don't have a lot of friends that are on Yelp, or at least even if they have accounts and I can find them, you know, via Facebook Connect, they don't seem to use those features of it very much. So I wonder if it's in their best interest to be pushing so much of that to everybody who does have accounts on Yelp. Because I mostly use it for things like finding out if a restaurant's cool and then trying to, you know, get a reservation via OpenTable, which is integrated on Yelp as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I agree with you from the standpoint that I think Yelp has always done one thing and one thing really well, which is reviews. And I think most people go to Yelp for reviews, and that's really been their bread and butter for a while. I don't know if Foursquare already has some type of integration with Yelp, but wouldn't that kind of make sense if the information was shared across Foursquare? You check, you know, the reviews and the check-in versus them trying to do it on their own. Or is that actually how it works now? Is Foursquare integrated?
Well, from Foursquare, you can't check into Yelp, but from Yelp, you can check into Foursquare.
Okay.
So, but then again, I mean, I find that those kinds of, when services like that team up, it's convenient for the user. But for example, I rarely go to Foursquare because I can check in through Path. And if I'm going, you know, it's like, I one service always loses in that regard because we're just creatures of habit. So it's like, I'm not going to separately go to three different places. I'm just going to go to the one and see if I can push that out to another service.
And I guess different communities too, right? There are different communities on different networks. And I don't know, you know what? Obviously the check-in experience is huge. I was just at a fundraiser last night and someone was showing me this game that has recently come out. It's doing really well. I don't know the name of it, but it's all about chasing zombies. And the idea being when you get to a certain venue, you find out if other friends of yours are there and you kind of chase zombies and have zombie fights based on if they've checked in or said that they're at the same location. And there was a bunch of people playing zombie fights on their iPhones. So the check-in experience is not going away. And in fact, it's getting more, dare I say, sophisticated.
Yeah. There are a lot of zombie games out there. Yeah. Leo and I have talked about a few of them on iPad Today, and it's like, they just keep coming. People love those. You know, one of the nice things that Yelp did for me. So I said, okay, Yelp got a redesign. Let's check it out. I went ahead and logged in. And you can actually see on my screen now, I have just written a review of Woodward's Garden. This is a restaurant in San Francisco. Actually, I didn't just go there, but what I had done is I had made a reservation for the restaurant through OpenTable, which is a feature of that restaurants can choose to be included on Yelp. And so because I did that, Yelp knew that I went, or at least knew that I had made a reservation, and then prompted me to write a review when I logged in, because I had just, I mean, I went, I liked it, and I didn't think to go to Yelp. It was just one of those things. That was very helpful to me, because I think a lot of times it's like, I have opinions about all sorts of places, but I don't necessarily feel compelled to write about it unless I'm very, very angry, which I have done on Yelp in the past. So I, you know, it took me a minute to write a review, you know, from what I could remember, like, yeah, I really, what did I have? Yeah, I had the fish. Yeah, that place was nice. It was a little small, but I liked it. And, you know, now Woodward's Garden gets another 4-star review from somebody, which is a very good review. So I like that, that portion of it. I wouldn't exactly call that social, just smart on their part.
Hmm. Yeah, so for our next story, Sarah, this is a very disturbing story and a very sad story as well, and also an example, I think, of how a big organization has failed to use social media in an intelligent and a human way. I'll try to make the story as simple as possible, and I know you initially found this, so hopefully you'll have some stuff to add. But basically, comedian Matt Fisher created a Tumblr post and blog where he talked about his sister who was killed in a car accident. Turns out the driver of another car was at fault, and what ensued was a battle with the insurance company, but not the insurance company of the other person, but with Progressive Insurance, who was the insurance company of the sister who was killed, and in fact ended up fighting this case in court and was defending the sister's killer. I'm sorry if this sounds killer being the driver who hit and killed her. So sorry if this sounds confusing. It is a little bit confusing, but the gist of it being that Progressive hasn't dealt very well with their response to some of the online reaction to people with their attacks towards Progressive. And they've made a pretty big, bad social media move as far as their comments on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. This is a pretty crazy story. What we're looking at is a Gawker article about the story. And yes, Amber summed it up pretty well. There was a discrepancy between what was on this woman's, what her insurance policy the total was and what Progressive wanted to pay. And the family, you know, in the event of her death, and ended up representing the other person who was deemed at fault. There were witnesses on the scene, so you know, it's just one of these things where this man who is a comedian, so he has kind of a reach online, and more people are going to read a story of his than maybe the average person. And he got a lot of attention for people saying, oh my gosh, this is a horrible story from Progressive Insurance. Mm-hmm. People take to Twitter, for example, say, you got to read this. This is crazy. You should, if you have Progressive Insurance, you should, you know, think twice. What if something like this happened? If Alex, if you can pull up that Gawker article again for a second. The reason we want to use this is because you can see a screenshot of Progressive on Twitter responding to people. And you can see that it's just a canned response. I mean, somebody was basically responded to one person and then copied and pasted anytime anybody was mentioning this incident that involved Progressive, because, you know, they're just searching for, you know, they're either getting that replied or they're searching for their name, which is the last thing you ever want to do ever, but certainly not in a case like this when we're actually talking about you know, grieving the death of somebody. And I mean, it's like a classic case of, holy crap, who is behind this account? Why are they doing this? Why do they look so callous and robotic? All of those tweets have since been deleted, but as the internet goes, they're not really deleted, because people had grabbed screenshots before they went away and written up, here's what not to do in social media. I think this is a really good example.
Yeah, I think people think that they can escape, you know, they can delete their tweets and then no one has taken screenshots. But I don't know about you, Sarah. I see it from friends of mine. I do it myself. If I see a company tweet something that's inappropriate, the first thing I do is grab a screenshot. Yep, and you really have to think harder before you do something like this. And I think it's just it's a really sad story. The only thing that I can hope for is that, like anyone who has heard this story and knows how sad it must be for this poor girl's family, is that maybe Progressive eventually will listen to the online reaction and do something, but it doesn't look good.
We got a response in the chat room that says, automated responses from a company regarding something that doesn't impact anyone but the family involved? Shocker. I will go ahead and disagree with you. It affects potentially anybody who buys Progressive Insurance. I mean, Progressive Insurance is a for-profit company. This is bad, really bad publicity, and this is the sort of thing where, you know, there are other insurance companies, and the rates aren't that different. I think that there are certain companies in cases where you feel a little bit stuck. You know, I feel a little bit stuck with Comcast Internet, for example. I feel a little bit stuck with Verizon for my cell phone. I have options besides Progressive Insurance. And yeah, rates are a little bit different, but that's where this comes into play. This, you know, whether they care or not about this individual family, they really do have to care about the people who can go ahead and stop using their services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think massive damage to their reputation. We saw the United Airlines story, which we talked about before, and you know, I can't put these on the same level, but the reality is, in that situation with Dave Carroll and the guitar getting broken, all the, I mean, that story has lasted for years and years and years, and has had huge damage as far as reputation to that company. And I think we'll see the same thing here. Now, Sarah, just to take a bit of a turn here, getting back into some of the social services out there. This is an interesting story that you uncovered about Clout coming up with a new way to do scoring online as far as establishing someone's influence on the web.
Yeah, so Clout has been a bit of a bad word around here. Amber and I are not the biggest fans of Clout. That's, of course, Clout with a K, KLOUT.com, which is a influence measurement tool designed to give not only myself, but anybody who looks me up an indication of where I am influential to others online and who influences me, and tries to give everyone a number rating based on that information. So, for example, how many Twitter followers I have, the same as Google Plus, subscribers on Facebook, that sort of thing. Now, Clout has, for a while, gotten a bad rap, even though a lot of people use it, because I think people are just uncomfortable with the idea of setting values, right? Because if you don't have a very high value, you're bitter about it. And if you do have a very high value, then How do you use that without seeming like you're bragging or, you know, better than everybody else kind of thing? Clout also has perks that they had started introducing a while ago, last year, where, for example, one of them that I was like, I kind of might like that, actually. If you have a clout score of, you know, above 75, I believe the highest you can go is 100. So it's out of 100. You decide to redeem this certificate, you could get entry into Virgin America's elite lounge in, you know, participating airports type of thing. That's something where I'm like, well, I don't have access to anything elite on any airline, so that's pretty cool. But then what do I have to do to ensure that I get a score of 75 or higher? I have to, you know, make sure that my clout score is okay and be logging in all the time and be sort of obsessing over this number. Well, clout has taken a lot of that into consideration and is changing their algorithm, the way that they figure out these number values for all of us, in a more real world, real life influencing way. So, for example, along with all of my Twitter followers, 10% of which might just be fakes anyway, what about, you know, the fact that I have a Wikipedia page? Or another example is what my job title is on LinkedIn, that kind of thing. Now, of course, all of those, I mean, I can call myself whatever I want at Twit because we don't really have specific job titles here, but I can see how stuff like that would factor in a little bit better because those are more of like reality-based online presences. I'm still not sure that we should all be obsessing over, you know, higher clout numbers, but I do think that the company is getting smarter about why, if someone has a high number, they have one. You know, Justin Bieber shouldn't have a higher number than maybe the president of the United States, for example.
And now that has been fixed, apparently,
yes, exactly.
According to this article. Yeah, you know, I think they needed to do some improvements as far as the technology that figured out your clout score. I know when we talked about this previously on the show, I had checked clout at one point and it said I was influential in hockey, which is not true because I don't think I've ever tweeted about hockey in my life. And there was a lot of things that were really screwed up. I just checked my profile today and it seems a little bit smarter, influential about social media technology and marketing, so that's a little more accurate. But I think they do need to kind of clean that up a little bit. And Sarah, you touched on this, so I may as well pick it up from there, because we talked last week about people buying Twitter followers. We had told our own stories about knowing people who had in fact bought followers, which can be very inexpensive to do but can damage your reputation in the long run. And on Sunday, I got a text message from a really good friend of mine who texted me about this service that a company called Status People had launched. And basically, it gives people a faker's score, which is kind of like the opposite of clout. It's basically determining if potentially some of your followers are fakes, and you maybe bought followers or you have a lot of spam accounts following you. And I wrote an article about this recently, and for our social tip of the week, thought I'd mention that if you want to poke around and have some fun and put some people's names into this new tool from Status People, you can get a sense of the real people who are in fact following them. It's not a perfect tool, but I think it's one of many out there, and definitely a new trend in social.
Isn't that just depressing beyond belief that we have to have these tools made to distinguish real, actual people from just fake spam, and we get excited about the tool because it works really well? I mean, that's sad.
Oh, yeah. I know. It's really, really sad. I mean, but the first thing, you know, I saw people, when I realized that this was becoming more popular, I saw people tweeting and saying that they had really good scores as far as their fake followers, and people feeling really proud about that instead of their clout scores. So I think we'll see more and more of this. And I think the good news is, even though it's not perfectly accurate, and what I mean by that, it only takes a small sample size of your actual followers, but I think it really is telling and will give people the hint who are buying followers that it's just not a good idea because they could damage their reputation.
Yes. So that is statuspeople.com if you want to go ahead and see what their features are. Yeah, they've got a whole lot of stuff there. Not just about fakers, but...
Oh, no. They have some good software as well, like a social media dashboard and all those things. And the Faker app, it was just an app that they did kind of as a side project, and obviously it got a ton of attention.
You know, we don't actually have this in our lineup, but the whole Twitter updating their API is probably just worth mentioning here, because something like Status People, which is going to be pulling in information via Twitter's API for social metrics, is a company that Twitter is deeming sort of safe as far as their updated API is concerned. If you're not familiar with this at all, a lot of developers are a little freaked out or a little angry, really, because what Twitter is starting to do is clamp down on not only the way that third-party applications and developers pull content from Twitter, but how they display it. It's kind of like Twitter wants its own branding and its own way of doing things to be a much more unified experience across the web. Unfortunately, Twitter users have a lot of different ways that we engage with Twitter content and tweets. And, you know, for a third-party app like Tweetbot, which is an app that I use on my Mac, on my iPad, and on my iPhone on a daily basis, it kind of scares me because they're technically a Twitter competitor. And if Twitter were to revoke the API access, then there just wouldn't be a company on that third-party app side. But something like Status People, and Twitter has a post on their blog that lays this out in detail, which, of course, has been picked apart by the blogosphere a million times over with people saying, see what this means? It's the end. Twitter's evil. But something like Status People, Twitter has said, this is actually a really good use of our API. I mean, these are the kinds of tools that we welcome. We're not going to try to shut these services down because, again, that's not really what Twitter does. Twitter's not in that business themselves, at least not yet. So thought it was worth
mentioning. Speaking of... Yeah, definitely. And speaking of Twitter, there is a new service out there from some of the people behind Twitter. I believe Ev Williams is behind this, if I'm right, Sarah.
Yes.
And that's our spotlight of the week. It's a service called Medium. Now, I signed up for Medium. I couldn't really get a lot of information in terms of what it does, but it appears a little bit, it reminds me a little bit of Tumblr and Twitter kind of mashed together. It's a place where you can share content. It's kind of vague as far as what they're going for. You can see some samples on the Medium website that give you a sense of how people are posting different information and pieces of content there. But I don't know. I signed up because they have a good track record, but still not too clear exactly what need this serves.
I signed up as well, Amber, and I'm still waiting for my actual access. We're looking at this is a post on Medium. It doesn't look like much. It just looks like a blog post from Ev Williams, of course, co-founder of Twitter, and now runs Obvious Corporation, who makes various tools, Medium being one of them, which was just announced. Now, this doesn't look like anything, but this is one of the versions of a Medium post. So this is a closed post where you can pretty much write whatever. It looks pretty traditional as far as blogging goes. But they have a few different models. So, for example, if I go ahead and click on something called Been There, Loved That, this is a collaborative post that is where Medium wants to stand out. So there are 141 items here, and I can filter by new or interesting. We're looking at interesting right now. And interesting means that, for example, if I go down to this castle in Granada, Spain looks really awesome. I want to go ahead and look at that full, wow, that's beautiful. Now up in the right-hand corner, I've got an option to say love it. I don't know if that's bleeding off of the screen for anybody watching, but there you go. This is my love it. So I can go ahead and say that. Now at that point, I have now contributed to the interestingness of that picture. And it'll, if there were a lot more likes, start floating up to the top of the page. So it's kind of like, you know, the cream rises type of a thing. Or I could filter by new. So if I had made this page and I had added a photo and I said, everybody at Twit gets access and we want to like have like the best Twit photos type of a thing. And Alex adds a photo, you know, 2 seconds ago, his photo would just appear in the new area. So in a way you say, okay, well, you can filter by new or interesting. That's not a novel concept. But as far as blogging goes, and particularly blogging by a group of folks, collaborative folks, very nice, Alex. Alex is putting together his Medium page.
Awesome. He says, I'm not wearing pants for people who are listening.
Exactly. That's very cute. Very cute. I like it. So that's... It's a way of reimagining publishing. And Ev Williams, in his post, laid it out pretty eloquently and said, listen, I created Blogger back in the day in 1999. I mean, I certainly wasn't blogging in 1999, so they were certainly ahead of their time. But he and some of his co-founders have obviously been thinking about the idea of blogging and publishing with mm-hmm. Twitter. They wanted to make something that was, you know, more direct, simple, shorter. This is sort of the next iteration of where they think publishing should go. And he had said, even though magazines can have been brought to the web and now they're on tablets and there's this whole sort of interactive experience, that's great, but we're still trying to recreate what a magazine looks like on the web. And we don't actually have to adhere by any of those rules. So why not start thinking of different ways that people can put content together, whether it's short stories or photos or a combination of both, or polls or whatever.
Now a new picture. Everybody was fired. But I think, Sarah, you're still part of the Twit team there.
Yeah,
right?
I guess I'm the last one left. This is sort of the splash page. This is what Alex is playing with in the background for Medium. Nothing's actually been written yet. I don't know, Amber. I mean, I certainly like the way this looks. It looks very mm-hmm. clean. It's very beautiful. I like the idea of stripping out comments totally and just being able to say, I love this, kudos to you type of a thing. Medium is not the first service to play around with this, but I don't know. I think we need accounts and be able to start using them before I know if I'm actually going to use this as a platform person.
You know what? It's all about the community, right? You start seeing some people in your own network using these tools. So I would just recommend, I think, for people who are listening right now, sign up, try to get your username, and just wait till you get a permission to get into it and see what happens with it, because it's so early that none of us have had a chance to play around with it. But we'll kind of wait and see what happens and have another update about that one pretty soon.
Yes, exactly. Medium.com, if you want to at least sign up and wait to be... wait for the floodgates to open. They say they're only open to select friends and family right now, and I don't know anybody over there well enough to be in that group, so we'll just wait patiently. Until then, we got a couple emails. The first one comes from Mike Tabbert. Thank you, Mike, for being... He's always emailing us and tweeting at us. He's from the Woodlands in Texas. He says, I found this website, and I thought it was amusing. And he's right, because he's talking about Rich Kids of Instagram. That's a Tumblr page, even though the name implies otherwise. Richkidsofinstagram.tumblr.com. Amber, have we not talked about this on the Social Hour yet?
I don't think we have. I've seen this all over the place over the past week, so I feel like perhaps we did, but I really don't think that we actually included it. So Rich Kids of Instagram, I saw it, I don't know how long ago, but... it's hilarious and disturbing at the same time.
It's so funny. I can't figure out... I mean, it seems like a parody, but it's not. I mean, the deal is that even though we're looking at a Tumblr page with these, you know, these gold frames around the pictures, these are basically just pictures that actually show up on Instagram with captions that have, you know, extremely funny hashtags like wealth and mansion and swagger. And the idea being is that you've got, you know, we've got this bad economy right now and people are really struggling. And then you've got these kids on Instagram who are posting these ridiculous photos that seem like parodies because they're just so ridiculous. Like that girl is just hanging out at home. And she tags it doesn't matter what her name is, but she tags mansion wealth. Very nice. I mean, is that real? Do you really have a jetpack? Come on.
I don't know. I'm just hoping it's like planking where everybody just starts doing it for fun and pretending they're rich and it's not actual just rich kids.
that makes more sense to me. That, I mean, you could probably, we're looking at a picture of a girl standing, you know, in an oceanfront estate. I mean, you could probably, maybe that's a hotel, right? You could run out there and take a picture and just say that that was your house. And so this is all just a bunch of funny stuff that maybe stemmed from a couple of actual pictures. But like that, maybe that's even, I don't know, some sort of a CG job.
Too funny.
In front of his mansion. I don't know. I don't believe it. Is that water real? But it is very entertaining.
It is very entertaining, so it's worth taking a look. We also had another email, and this one is from Chuck from West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm not going to read his whole email. It's a long email. It's very thoughtful, but I'll just grab kind of the gist of it. He has about 5,000 people on Google Plus in his circles. He's followed by more than 1,500 people. His stream moves really fast. He gets lots of posts and comments. But he's wondering why people like tech bloggers and reviewers keep saying that Google Plus is a ghost town. And he just wants some clarification on what we think. I thought, Sarah, as I mentioned before the show, the best thing to do would be to go to Google Plus and ask people there what they thought of this statement, because I've been hearing it all over the place. And you know, the interesting thing here, Sarah, is that I posted this message, and I probably post on Google Plus maybe twice a week, and literally there are probably 20 or so people who have already commented on Chuck's question, and really thoughtful comments from all these people. I'll talk about one from Michael, who just posted this a little while ago, saying that Google Plus is not a ghost town at all, especially if you're into photography or you have some type of other interest or passion. He's talking about why Facebook is mostly about friends and family, and Twitter more about breaking news and other cool stuff. But Google Plus really is, again, about interests. So, and he also says, hi to you, Sarah.
Hi
to Sarah Lane. And a lot of the comments were really like this, just saying that Google Plus is a great place to share content if you have some type of passion or interest, and some really thoughtful stuff there. So hopefully that helps Chuck a little bit. You know, whether or not the media may think it's a ghost town and they don't like the numbers and they're not participating there, I still do see some really good quality conversation.
I do. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I am not the most avid Google Plus user, but I do. I lurk a lot and I post from time to time. And I think the point is, if it's not a ghost town for you, then it doesn't matter what anybody says, because as far as your experience goes, they're wrong. And, you know, don't sweat it.
I'm with you, Sarah.
All right. Now, Amber, I know we're getting you've got to scoot in a few minutes. Do you want to skip over our meme of the week, or is this a must?
Well, I kind of want to skip over it only because I would like to devote more time to it and showing the pictures and everything. It's a really great meme about NASA and a guy who works there who has a mohawk, and I won't say any more. But Sarah and I can perhaps dig into it the next week, so you'll have a reason to listen up, because this is a fun meme of the week. So it'll be our meme of next week.
There you go. That's a tease if I ever heard it. I want to know more. You're going to have to wait a week, though. Quickly, a reminder that for all of those folks who got a hold of us via email on Google Plus, we got a couple voicemails too, and thank you so much, because I was giving you a hard time last week about not calling us. Try to keep those voicemails to 30 seconds or less. We got a couple 2-minute, very thoughtful voicemails that I really wanted to include, but I don't want to cut you off. And so if you can make it just a little bit tighter, then it'll be very helpful. That number is 2626 social, and of course you can write us at thesocialhour@twit.tv. Amber and I are both on Twitter, on Google Plus, on Facebook. So you know how to get a hold of us, and we are listening. You can also record a video if you're feeling brave, upload it somewhere, and then send that link to thesocialhour@twit.tv. Want to thank Ford Social. They're our second sponsor of this episode of The Social Hour. Could that be more perfect? Ford and social, cars and social. The cool thing about Ford is that they are not only working on some of the most amazing technologies ever to be even thought up, that are not only in some Ford models now, but are being thought up for future models, but they want to know more from the community about what they should be adding. For example, if you go to social.ford.com, which is where I'm learning about some of these ideas, you can see ideas about Wi-Fi music sharing between two Fords, for example. I can think of when that would come in handy. There was an idea submitted by a kid, really smart kid, about a biodiesel hybrid. When you think about that, it's like hybrid cars are pretty cool. And then, you know, if you're using vegetable oil too, I mean, now you've really figured it out. Automatic sunscreens when you're in your car, right? So thinking about stuff that people really care about. I'm looking at a solar-powered Fusion. And when you click into some of these ideas, you get a little bit more information about what the idea is, who thinks it's cool. You can vote it up. You can tweet about it. You can add comments. And that's the neat thing about this, is that maybe I don't have any great ideas, but I really enjoy browsing creative other folks' ideas. So I can go in there and say, you know what? That really awesome wind turbine under the hood idea is good. I hope that happens. I want to tell other people about it. Let's get some momentum going. So that's all the stuff that Ford is building into their projects. They really want it to be a collaborative experience. And as social people, we really love that. Check out social.ford.com. You can submit ideas. You can like your favorite ideas. And while you're there, you can also read a blog post that our very own Leo Laporte submitted about his discussion with a real visionary over at Ford, Jim Bukowski. It's very interesting. He had a chance to hear about all sorts of stuff that Ford has coming down the pipe. That's social.ford.com, and we thank them for their support of our show. Amber, it's time for Rad or Fad, and I hope you've brought your A-game.
I have, but, you know, I'm looking at this gadget, and sometimes when I find gadgets to talk about on the show, I'll look at them a couple times and think, oh, that is so cool, I can't wait to talk about it, and then I think, I hope this isn't a fake, because, you know, sometimes you see these little gadgets or tech toys online that someone has mocked up. They look real and they, in fact, aren't. But I think this is the real deal, Sarah. So for a Rad or Fad this week, wanted to talk about the bike charge dynamo. Now, what this is this little contraption, and it goes onto your bike wheel. The idea being that you can charge your smartphone, your iPhone, for example, basically by biking, and it will charge it up on the go. Now, a full charge takes about 2 to 3 hours. So you're going to have to bike a while, but this is great incentive for people who want to get some exercise. And it starts to work after about 5 kilometers. So I guess it's about 3 miles.
5 kilometers? Gosh.
I know. So it takes a while, but I can imagine people who may think that this is kind of neat because they want to be able to charge their phone if they're going for a really long, long bike ride, right? I don't know if it's for me, Sarah, because frankly, I just don't bike that far and I don't see using something like this, but I thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely rad if you are going to be biking long enough for it to be to be helpful. Yeah, I guess on a bike, 5 kilometers is not that far. I'm definitely biking that much in a session at the gym. But, yeah, no, could I do that? Could I charge my phone on my little reclining bike at the gym? If so, I'm all over it. Because I think being able to charge our phones in more places than are available to us now is a good thing in general. My phone actually just died when I was at dinner last night, and I was so mad at myself. Like, how could I let this happen? I really wanted it on the bus ride home, and I'm just sitting there looking out the window like, why didn't I just charge my phone when I was at work earlier? It's so stupid. If I would have had a bike, my whole world would have been solved. Yeah.
Well, someone was just making fun of me recently because I told them when I go to the gym, I go on the elliptical machine and I always have at least one phone with me and I answer emails. And they thought this was very strange. And I'm thinking, well, what else are you going to do? I don't know. I mean, that's a really sad reflection of our society that we need to be so plugged in. But I think you're right. More and more, you have your smartphone with you. You run out of battery juice all the time. It happens to me on a regular basis. So although maybe the second generation of something like this might be better as far as not having to bike quite as far, I do like the idea of having these type of chargers more accessible. And if they inspire people to exercise, that's perhaps a good thing as well.
There's
so I think
also,
it's kind of rad.
I don't know about Toronto, but in San Francisco, where I live, there are a lot of people who commute on bikes. I mean, it's not even really exercise. It's just point A to point B. And if you can charge your phone when you know you're going to be on your bike for, I don't know, 20 to 30 minutes twice a day, that's a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm. And then because your phone is in a secure place, that's the only thing that I was thinking about. You don't want your phone kind of bouncing around. And of course, you don't want to be texting or emailing while you're biking because that's not safe. Other than that, I think it is kind of rad. I think in a few iterations of it, perhaps it'll be even better. So that is our rad gadget for the week.
Yeah, it's rad. I love it. And that concludes this episode of The Social Hour, which is actually a little bit longer than an hour this week because we couldn't help it. The social overfloweth, and we tried to get through as much as possible. We will get to our meme of the week, which involves NASA and Mohawks. I mean, If that isn't a reason to join next week, I don't know what is. Remember, we will be live next week on Friday. It's our new time. We're a couple months into it now. 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. But you can watch on demand. We don't really mind if you watch us live or not, as long as you're enjoying the show. And you can also listen. We have audio feeds as well as a variety of video feeds, depending on how you want to love our content. That's the verb I was looking for. Just love us. We don't care how. Just love us.
Yeah, just love the Social Hour. Yeah, and we've been getting great tweets from people, I find, Sarah. You know, lots of feedback on Twitter and ideas for the show, and that is awesome. I mean, it just makes our job so much easier, and also just the collaborative process of putting the show together is fantastic. So keep that up. Thank you so much, and hopefully you'll send videos and audio and lots of other material for us to use, too.
Well, that's the end of my week, Amber. I don't know what you have planned for the night, but I have a hot date with my couch and a little Hulu Plus. So with that, thanks everybody for watching or listening. We'll see you next week. Amber, I will see you online probably within an hour, because that's what we do.
All right. Thanks, Sarah, and thanks to everybody for watching. We'll see you soon.